Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky. It's great to be back.
Good to see you, Adam.
I don't know about you guys, but January, you know, we had our fall was not particularly cold, but January has turned out to be, we got 18 inches a few days ago, and it's turned out to be pretty cold, and I think it's going to, you know, next week is going to be even colder for us. It's going to be, you know, below zero. So it'll be a cold here, maybe another great, you know, winner for postseason football for the NFL. So,
Adam, I'm wearing my flannel shirt just to represent the cold here in Ohio.
There you go. And it's pretty cold here along the Mason-Dixon line as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's, of course, cold weather, you know, that brings us back to our good friends, the Russians, another cold place that no American wants to live. And, you know, we're talking about an article today that was written by SIPRI, and SIPRI's the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. So their purpose is in the name. And they write an article called Blurring Conventional Nuclear Boundaries, Nordic Development's Global Implications. And the article essentially says, hey, you know, the Norwegians and the Finns and the Swedes are building these advanced precision capabilities, missiles and other things. You know, the Finns are buying JASSM ER and F-35s to American systems. And the Norwegians are going to build a hypersonic cruise or a hypersonic, you know, PGM. And the article argues it, and it's an article by Wilfred Wan and Git de Plessis. I think that's how you say that.
I think so.
And so they make this argument, hey, all these advanced precision capabilities in the, you know, in the Scandinavian countries, and the Nordic countries are bad because, I mean, look how close you are to these really important Russian targets, and the Russians may see those as potentially, you know, useful in taking out Russian nuclear capabilities, you know, whether the base at Kola, whether some other, I mean, Kaliningrad is right there. I mean, Russian ships can't get out. Yeah, they can't get out. I mean, the you know, the Scandinavian, Nordic countries can essentially shut the Russians down in the north. And so, therefore, this is destabilizing. Now, as with most articles that talk about instability, whatever they think is destabilizing is bad. And, of course, we don't define what that means. There's no definition of stability. So we have to just take for granted that what they don't like is destabilizing. And then, of course, they say this could also lead to an arms race. And, of course, arms races are bad. I've not seen any evidence to explain why they're bad instead of stabilizing, but we should believe they're bad. And so this is sort of the argument they make, and, you know, they warn us that we need to, you know, be very careful about building, you know, advanced precision capabilities. Now, Curtis, I think this is, you know, it's sort of a passion of yours in terms of the idea that, you know, we've talked about how the Russians do fear, right? This is something that the Russians clearly fear American PGMs because they fear we're going to fly F-22s and F-35s, attrit their, you know, their anti-aircraft batteries and their S-400s, and then we're going to be able to strike targets in Moscow, and they can't stop us. That's their fear. And so, therefore, I think for you, this article sort of has some validity, but maybe you disagree with the conclusions that they or the sort of the assertions they lead you to?
Well, thanks, Adam. I think what really attracted me to this article is this argument now by a peace research institute. So at least the word nuclear is not in their acronym title. That now we're actually having a conversation, or at least these two gentlemen are offering that Western technology and conventional weapons are adding to some stabilization question. We've kind of moved on from the, well, nukes are destabilizing, nuclear cruise missiles are destabilizing when the Americans have them. And so we should just use these conventional weapons because we're so good at it. And Adam, you and I have discussed for the 2 years that we've been doing this, the idea that the Russians, we believe the Russians fear our nuclear forces much less than our conventional prowess and our ability to strike targets with conventional munitions plentifully and with great accuracy and speed, and that we've been using that capability as sort of a surrogate for more nuclear weapons. So like, nukes are bad, so let's have more of these really exquisite conventional munitions. And now these gentlemen are saying, yeah, but you know what? That has a destabilizing factor all into its own, because they place the adversary's nuclear arsenal at some risk. And I think it's an interesting argument. It is the very goal of the Western system, NATO and the U.S., to place those at risk with non-nuclear capabilities. But I think the point of these authors is the end result is the same, except the adversary thinks that we are more likely to use these conventional weapons than if they were nuclear weapons. And that is the crux, Adam, of why we think that it is America's conventional capabilities and our prowess and our credibility to use them that has our adversaries really more fearful. And we can see that in the maturation of the Russian doctrine, deterrence doctrine, that has occurred here recently.
So, Jim, let me ask you a question then. So is the solution, so having nuclear weapons or adding any more, that's destabilizing. Having advanced PGMs is destabilizing. So is the solution then to let the Russians know that we mean them no harm? Because I'm not sure if everything we do is destabilizing, if any attempt to defend ourselves or deter the Russians is destabilizing, what then is the solution?
Well, dear friend, you shouldn't be leading the witness. So not really a good question. So I'll move that in a different direction, because and I'll answer your question that I think you're asking without telling me the answer. So first of all, I'm going to give you a definition, first of all, of what I would say is what I think this author is saying is stabilization. And that is that we remain at the status quo. And a status quo, whatever it may be right now, is where I think because we don't know what the next step is, good or bad. And a status quo, at least between the United States and Russia, is we are not at war. And so I will say that the stabilization is that we remain not at war, at peace. And deterrence is designed to do exactly that. It's designed to make our adversaries so fearful of taking an action that they don't take it. Now, we start out with that premise because we're a deterrence organization. So now you say, well, are we destabilizing because we add or subtract nuclear weapons or add or subtract the conventional capabilities? Well, that, again, I'll use Curtis's answer, is in the minds of our adversaries. Are they in fact doing nothing, so we remain at status quo? Or are they adding and subtracting to not remain at status quo? And I would argue that if you see the buildup of the Russian military, especially their nuclear forces and a lot of their aggression, especially on a conventional, on the battlefield itself, you see that in Ukraine, you see our adversaries in China, they are not seeking a status quo situation because they are the ones that are making the initial actions to build their forces very quickly to pull us off that status quo. So I don't know if that answers fully your question, except I at least started by saying that's deterrence. We do not want to be at war. We want to maintain peace. And I'm going to add a little piece. We want to maintain peace without giving up our strategic needs and our way of life. I mean, the answer you have is that you tried to lead me to is, well, let's just not do anything. Let's just give up our arms, sit down, climb on our knees and say, what do you want us to do to be at peace? And we're not going to do that. That's not deterrence either. And that's not peace either. Every country that you've seen historically that thinks that's peace regrets it. And you can pull up historic examples.
So is your argument that it is not better to live on your knees than to die on your feet? Is that what you're trying to tell me, Jim? I mean,
I'd rather live on my feet and live in America in our way of life than either of those. So I have a slightly different view. Again, keep trying to lead the witness here. So anyway, I want to make one other comment, Curtis, before you jump in. And that is, though, this conventional capability in the Nordic states, though, I think has a huge strategic purpose that does make Russia consider taking any action, which, by the way, is deterrence for the reasons you mentioned. And we're starting to see that. We're talking about Greenland recently. I'm sorry, our listeners are well aware of all the discussions about the importance, strategic importance of Greenland, the Arctic Sea, especially from the Russian standpoint, and we don't want to lose a foothold there, because that will bring an instability that we don't want and could lead to war.
I'd like to offer just a friendly amendment to Jim's definition of stability and add to that, and I think this is maybe the perspective of our two authors of this piece, is that stability comes when you've removed the other side's incentive to go first. And the argument here is that these conventional weapons are not only capable enough of striking first, because they're not nuclear, they're psychologically more usable, if you will, for lack of a better term. And going first with those weapons is not only, because it's more acceptable, is actually likely more credible. And that is now destabilizing because of what could happen on the other end. And so, nuclear or not, we now see the issues here where our adversaries are fearful of escalation, fearful of this user-lose mentality that they might be placed under, and that this is part of that instability question.
But I don't buy it.
Yeah, I don't buy it either. I think so I look at it a different way. I'm not sure we're seeing Russia looking at this as much destabilizing as the disarmament community thinks it's just. Is destabilizing. And I think and part of this, I'm going to go into the psyche, and I'm not a psychologist. I'm sort of maybe need psychiatric help, but I'm not a psychologist. But my view is the reason that psyche's there is because we have been willing to use conventional weapons to keep escalation from occurring, but people look at that as adversarial. You look at Iraq, et cetera. There are examples of that, and we have been very, very restrained, in many ways too restrained, in my opinion, for the use of nuclear weapons, not engaging them, but the use to say we do have them. And they are at the foothold and of usage. If we see an existential threat, whether we do that or not, that could be destabilized. We could discuss that in general. But going back to history, the recent history is we have not been as sheltered of our conventional forces, especially when we look at places, again, like Iraq, you know, Syria, et cetera. That could be a worthwhile discussion. I'm not sure we can answer that completely here.
So is the reason that, you know, we both agree, Curtis, that the Russian
sphere. You disagree
sphere,
with me? You just
not necessarily. Not necessarily, but
likely so.
But this fundamental problem of the Russian sphere conventional precision strike, and I don't necessarily think it's destabilizing for nuclear issues. For the simple fact that if you were to use a conventional capability to strike nuclear command and control targets or, you know, nuclear weapons themselves, I don't know anybody who says, well, we went conventional, so the Russians have to go conventional too. Well, I don't know anybody that says that. Everybody, I think, knows or at least fears that if we start striking Russian command and control targets, taking out their, you know, their early warning satellites, radars, if we start trying to, I don't know, target launch facilities or launch control centers or anything, or targeting nuclear bombers, I don't know anybody that's like, they won't go nuclear. So I don't know that it really matters whether you target nuclear stuff with a nuclear weapon, high yield, low yield, or with a conventional. I don't think it matters. Well, it's the kind of target, the kind of target that you target. And then regardless of what you use, the Russians are going to see that as an existential threat to their security, and they're most likely going to respond with a nuclear response. So to me, it's not stabilizing or destabilizing either way. It doesn't really affect it because we know what they'll do. They know we can target it, or that the Norwegians or the Finns can. So to me, it's more stabilizing. Because now the Russians know that they have additional targets that they're going to have to target, not just, you know, the nuke bases in NATO, but now they know that the Finns and the Norwegians and the Swedes can also target all of these facilities, these nuclear facilities. So they have to be more conservative in their actions.
That's called deterrence, I believe.
So that's an interesting perspective, the idea that it creates more targets that the Russians have to worry about within NATO if we've got these conventional systems that can place them at risk. I would also argue that something that I think our authors here sort of miss the boat, because they're always looking to place blame on the West and never on the East. And that is that whether or not the Russian doctrine itself is destabilizing, right? This idea that if you attack a Russian nuclear target with a conventional weapon, that is tantamount to worthy of a possible nuclear response, is likely a situation where we think that we are fighting our way out of a nuclear war by using conventional munitions and trying to remove their potential nuclear munitions, when in reality you may draw in that first strike with regard to a nuclear response, because your first strike is the conventional strike, right? But their first strike is the nuclear response, and so there's an escalatory factor there. This idea, I think maybe we can all agree, that this idea that if we attack conventionally only, that they will only respond conventionally only, is probably something we should not be betting the house on.
I don't know anybody that does.
Yeah, I don't.
I don't know. I think there are a lot of folks out there, the same ones who believe that the East will disarm if we disarm, and will follow us in the lead, will do the same. And we have a history of this, Adam, of our senior leaders not targeting Russian cities in the hopes that they will respond in kind to us. This is not old thinking. This is not new thinking. This is very old thinking. And I think it still permeates our strategists and diplomats today.
Yeah, well, I would say, and I agree with that, Curtis. I think that, again, is why I said, I think more of the disarmament community is the fearful ones, not necessarily the Russians. However, I think what Russia does fear is losing any strategic advantage that they already have, which once again, you know, leads to status quo. And that's why I always say, as long as we're not at war, or we're not, you know, and we maintain this peaceful negotiations and the ability to bring people to the table without shooting at each other, this is good. And so I don't see where this may, and now I'll sort of flip this over just for argument. So now in the Nordic states, if it takes a strategic advantage away, conventional weapons or nuclear weapons or Star Wars photon torpedo weapons, I don't care. The weapon doesn't matter. It's the effect of taking a strategic advantage. And that's what has to be negotiated and understood in any deployment of any weapon system.
Sure. Right.
You know, the two most addictive drugs in the world today are heroin and opium. And the problem is... Well, fentanyl just kills you. You don't get addicted. You
I guess
die.
That's true.
There's no addiction problems with fentanyl. But hopium is a drug that is it's widespread amongst, you know, the intellectual class. It's why diplomats are you know, it's you know, addiction is rampant in the diplomatic corps around the world because they're all hooked on hopium. And, you know, it's the disarmament community, they're probably the biggest pushers of hopium out there. And so, you know, part of what my challenge here is as you read these things, you know, I've never tried hopium, much less gotten addicted to it. And so I sort of look at these and I'm like, well, what is the only sort of solution I can ever find to these kinds of arguments is, you know, capitulation, because they never offer a particularly compelling, okay, well, you know, build cyber capabilities that can, you know, shut down the country. That's your better solution. Or, you know, build space weapons. There's never, well, nukes are bad, conventionals, everything that you can build to defend yourself, they're all bad and destabilizing, and they'll always, 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 always lead to an arms race. There's never an option except instability in arms racing and ultimately war. So what do you do?
Well,
you negotiate disarmament. That's what you did.
Yeah, but I want to counter your argument a little bit, Adam, just for again for the discussion. And that is that there is another argument aside from capitulation. Although I will say that capitulation, if you look historically at every country that capitulates at an aggressor, it doesn't turn out very well. There may be one example I remember reading something, but it was a small issue. Anyway, but my view is I am hopeful. I am hopeful, and I believe Reagan's accounted for this, although I think it goes back beyond him. I am hopeful that the lion lies down with the lamb as long as I'm the lion. Okay.
Yeah.
Then I'm happy with that. Okay. Because that works out. Okay. But you will never remain at status quo by simply surrendering. That's because we're not surrendered now. So where's the status quo? Where's stability?
Are you telling me that you, like McNamara, when you retired, you started getting hooked on hopium? Is that what you're telling me, Jim? Because hopium, if for one thing, it's like Bill Perry. I mean, Bill Perry like really went all in on hopium after he left government after the second offset. I mean, he's credited, you know, I'm reading Chip Wars right now, and he's credited, you know, with that second offset and our ability to essentially, you know, force the Soviets to capitulate, and you know, he did great work at one point in time, and then now it's, you know, disarmament hopium. And so I see Jim as, you know, maybe, you know, a little hopium dust has sort of made it your
oh,
way.
Oh yeah, I've been sniffing it quite well there, Adam. But seriously, I look forward to the day when we have peace and all our adversaries turn their weapons into plowshares. I'd be happy to see that.
Well, I'll just remind our readers that Adam and I wrote a great piece on hopium back in March of 2023. I encourage you to go look it up. And NIDS is a peace organization. We are a peace advocacy organization, much
but
like
through
CIPRI,
strength.
But we just want to get there a different way. Now, let me inject another portion of this talk, and that is that if you're going to have these kinds of conventional weapons, these high tech, which are very expensive, we've got to talk about again about how do you afford all of these. And we've debated the NATO funding issues for a while here, but just recently here in the second week of January, incoming President Donald Trump made a statement that NATO needs to move to 5% GDP funding, and the polls are all about that. They are all for it, probably because they are just about there as it is. And the Germans are not so much interested in this. In fact, the Chancellor of Germany, who I believe is lost a no confidence vote in the end of 2024, and is now going. They're going to have snap elections here in February. He basically made a statement and said, hey, you know, Germany just made it to 2% this year in 2024, and we're not able or interested in going to 5%. In fact, I'll quote in this other article here. It says, that would only be possible with massive tax increases or massive cuts to many things that are important to us. Unquote. I don't know what's more important when you ask the question about living on your knees or dying on your feet sort of thing than making sure that you have a social system to fund before you debate whether or not
look at the United States, right? We clearly know, if you see the latest public opinion polls, the vast majority of Americans see China as a very, not a competitor, as a threat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They see Russia as a threat. They see Iran as a threat. They see Hamas and Hezbollah as a threat. Americans look externally and see many threats. Yep. But yet the United States in 2024 took in the federal government, just the federal government, took in $4.4 trillion in taxes, right? In I'm trying to think what our GDP is, like 26 yeah, trillion, 20, something 26 like trillion. That.
Yeah.
And then and what did we spend in entitlement programs? We took in 4.4 trillion. We spent 4.6 trillion in entitlement programs. So defense, because entitlement programs come first. Right. They're mm-hmm. not discretionary spending. So 100% of the defense budget came out of money that was borrowed. Over $2 trillion that were borrowed. That's discretionary spending. And it was all borrowed money. So if we were only to spend what we bring in, every single dime the federal government takes in would go to entitlement programs, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. We spent $1.8 trillion, twice the defense budget, just on poverty reduction programs last year. If you look at the state and local governments, which they spend about $4.5 trillion a year, you know, they're not the only governments, or the feds are not the only one. So altogether, we spent about $10 trillion. We brought in eight. And, you know, the state and local governments spend about 65% of their budgets on entitlement programs. So if you look at it, that means we spend about $7 to $8 trillion of all government programs on entitlements last year. So the United States really has no room to talk, because if you look at how we spend money, we spend it all on entitlement, because why? Entitlement programs buy votes. Defense spending doesn't buy votes. And so our house is not in order. And if we were Germany or any of these other countries that didn't have the world's reserve currency, we would not be able to keep living like we do. We would be in the exact same boat. Because
so
they
you're sympathetic to the German response here.
I mean, it's a reality.
And
they're not going to, this is the problem, is the only time they're going to actually, because they're hooked on, I don't know what you call it. It ain't hopium, because entitlement programs don't bring you hope. Is there another drug for dependency? Because that's what they bring you, right? The whole point of entitlement programs is to get you dependent upon the program so that you vote for the politicians who then give you the money, right? That's why they exist. Yeah, but it's a, you know, and so this problem that Europe's facing is one we have as well. And we have, because we're the world's reserve currency, we don't have to face it quite like they do.
There's one other issue, though. I mean, I'm looking at a map right now. There seemed to be a proximity of Germany to their adversaries that's slightly different than the United States. And so you would think that would, and they know, maybe from the wrong end, but they know what it's like to have a war in your country that's a world war. And I'd say all of Europe knows that too.
But that's the whole point of Poland, is for the give the Germans and the Russians a place to fight.
No,
we love our Polish listeners. Yeah, so please forgive Adam for that. For that insensitive statement.
Lord, I apologize. Starving pygmies down there in New Guinea.
But you know what I'm saying is that they have even more of a strategic interest and need to shore up their forces in a way that will repel an adversary who's licking their chops at their land.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you, but it doesn't seem to change, you know, decision making.
Yeah, so it just goes to prioritization, right? And what is most important, and this question about, you know, how do you balance this quest for a less nuclear or a non-nuclear military, which is obviously then heavily conventionally armed and thus much more expensive. In order to maintain this deterrence in Europe, compared to if you allowed more nukes, if you allowed more nations, NATO nations to have nukes, and used nukes to buttress the security, I would argue that that is actually more stabilizing, because you're less likely to use them, and they're a lot less expensive.
Mm-hmm. You're calling for a new look policy.
A new look policy. Yeah.
I mean, it worked. It did the one thing it was supposed to do.
And so that was the first offset, right? You mentioned the second offset. So when we look at that, I'm advocating maybe the first offset is where we need to go again. But the point here is that NATO needs to think about this. And if we have issues, if there are nations who would rather spend their hard-earned tax dollars and redding debt on other things than defending their own homeland and ensuring their own liberty, then you need to do it less expensively. And perhaps the answer is not more precision munitions that might be destabilizing. Maybe the answer is more nukes that might actually be more stabilizing, depending on the perspective.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to drop the conversation there, gents. Our time is up. So it's a good read. I'm glad somebody's, you know, taking a look at conventionals.
Yeah,
and you know, the Russians and the Chinese do fear them, which is why they built more nukes. So they get some things right. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, as often is, it's there's a couple of the details that a lot of folks seem to always misunderstand. And you know, but it's a good conversation, good article. So take a read. It's, you know, on CPRI's website, and of course, you know, as we tell you every week. You know, Curtis spends a good amount of time in the mornings going through the articles to post on Twitter. And so you get, you know, if you go to the follow the Twitter feed or the, excuse me, the X feed, and you know, he's got good articles, great commentary, makes you think.
Right. You can find his Think Deterrence on X.
And yeah, Jim, Jim has a great new article out. What was that article out, that last article you published?
I haven't published an article recently for you.
No, not for me, but the other one for our more technically interested folks.
I've forgotten the title already. I'm already working on a new one, but it had something to do with the survivability of materials in the National Ignition Facility and short pulse neutrons. I'm not sure it's even accessible by most of our
folks. I don't even know what you said.
Yeah, if you're interested in short pulse neutrons, Jim's your guy. Just send him an email.
Or if you need something to sleep.
But that, this should keep you awake, Curtis. But anyway, Adam, I did want to mention that we have, we recently got onto Rumble and we began fiddling around with it a little bit. If you haven't been to Rumble and looked up the National Institute for Deterrent Studies, we'd be posting not our podcast, but our actual video feed from all of the things we do, whether they're HUSI events, the podcasts that we do. We do get those videos there so you can see what we look like live. And go there and look at our new artwork that's going up there. Our marketing person, Greg Sharp, I think I can mention him, and our podcast producer, Kimberly Charrington, have been working together to get that looking really snazzy. You ought to take a look at it out on Rumble. So take a look at us. Tell us what you think.
Yeah, and Curtis was talking earlier today about doing a podcast from a shower, and I think he was going to call it The Full Monty was going to be the name of the podcast. But
Munitions and Monty?
So, all right. Well, you know, don't forget about Global Security Review, you know, podcast, articles. We're always, you know, there's Deterrence Down Under and Real Space Strategy and, you know, all sorts of good stuff going on. So always remember that. And of course, as we sign off, as we do every week, we always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.